Behind the images of Australian homesteads, beach houses and the sails of the Sydney Opera House lies an enthralling history of how Australians have responded to the natural landscape and urban environments to shape a nation. Now, that nation has its first encyclopedia of Australian philosophy, a massive research project documenting and analysing our built environment from Indigenous beginnings to colonial times, the modern age, and the here and now. This is a massive undertaking involving 1,000 entries. So how did the editors decide what was worthy of inclusion and what was not? Well, let's ask them. Philip Goad is Chair of Architecture at the University of Melbourne, where his co-editor, Julie Willis, is Associate Professor of Architecture. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
This is an Australian first, but have other nations documented their architectural history in this encyclopedic way?
Well, Alan, it is an encyclopedia of Australian architecture, and not many other nations have done this. The Americans have, the Indians have. It seemed to be a very 19th century preoccupation, but very few countries of Australia's size have their own encyclopedia of architecture.
So there are, for instance, entries here on building types, office buildings, observatories, churches and parliament houses, where you'll find details of all the state parliaments. But some buildings are considered significant enough to warrant their own entries. So, Julie, what were the criteria for selecting them?
Well, we looked at the level of importance of these buildings. We checked World Heritage Registers and national prominence. So we picked out really only a handful of key iconic buildings and places to profile with their own entries.
So you've got Parliament House in Canberra, you've got the Sydney Opera House, the buildings you can't not have.
That's right, but perhaps some that are a little more obscure, such as Elizabeth Farm and Port Arthur. Just a few things to demonstrate key moments in Australian architectural history.
And also to a building like the Shine Dome or the Australian Academy of Science, of national significance. And, of course, the Royal Exhibition Building in Melbourne, which, as Julie says, was World Heritage listed.
Indeed, yes. The first entry under A is Aboriginal architecture, which gives rise to the often asked question of how there can be an Aboriginal architecture if Indigenous Australians traditionally occupied simple windbreaks and huts and moved from place to place.
Well, this entry, written by Paul Memmott from the University of Queensland, I guess in many respects disputes that sort of proposition and suggests that there was permanent habitation constructed by Indigenous Australians and that it varies incredibly across the entire nation. And I think this entry is really important in, if you like, correcting the mythical idea of Aboriginals being completely nomadic people.
How have we managed to ignore this rather significant fact?
I think probably because there hasn't been enough published scholarship. There's been an incredible amount of focus on the so-called problems of Indigenous people in Australia, but not enough on really documenting actual living habits, documenting the way they live, the way they build things particularly. And it's only really now in the last 15 years that particularly Paul Memmott has brought much of this material together.
While you can read here about some very fine Australian architects, it's by no means attempting to be comprehensive. Julie, there must have been some very political decisions about which contemporary living architects were to be included.
Well, we had the help of an advisory board which guided us as to the kind of architects that they thought had reached a sufficient level of prominence, and that goes right across the board from the very earliest architects in Australia to those contemporary. But we did decide to include only those individuals and practices that had had at least 10 years of practice and that they'd reached a certain level of prominence and peer recognition for inclusion. We would have loved to have included many more, but we were under restrictions as to how long the volume could be.
Yes, our publishers didn't want us to make the book too big.
Well, this hasn't stopped you having a few dead international stars, such as Pugin and Marcel Breuer.
Yes, that's right. And I think readers will be very surprised at how much work the great Gothic Revival architect Pugin did in Australia, particularly in Tasmania. And also they forget that Marcel Breuer, one of the great post-war international modernists, actually had a building near Sydney.
Yes, well, I'd certainly forgotten that. Pugin I always remember because there's a Pugin church, much disfigured, not far from here. Julie, there are some examples here, aren't there, of architects who didn't quite measure up to expectations?
Well, I have to say that some of the earliest architects who arrived in Australia had some very colourful engagements with the profession. I think that they were very good at self-promotion. We have Daniel Deering Matthew, who arrived at an opportune moment in 1812. He put his services forward, designed buildings, and unfortunately they were dreadfully constructed and very overpriced, and they fell down very soon. He was soon eclipsed by greater architects who arrived, including Greenway. And then there's the marvellous story of George Cookney, who also arrived in Sydney. As our author puts it, he made the least of his opportunities in Australia. He, at the age of 26, he was elected Colonial Architect of Sydney, but lasted only 12 months in the job. And he eventually ended up on a road gang in Tasmania as he'd slowly burned his way through every contact he'd made. Our author says that it was a salient lesson for young budding architects.
A strikingly downward trajectory to his career. Given that in the next part of the programme we're going to be talking about women in architecture, it might be interesting to know what proportion of the architects that you mention in your book are male.
Well, a very large proportion are male, I have to say, but there are women architects profiled in the volume, and we've done that quite deliberately, not partly to raise their profile, but also because they were prominent in their own right. So we have an entry, say, on Marion Marnie Griffin, who was a very prominent architect, being the wife of Walter Burley Griffin. But we also have people like Ellison Harvey, who rose to great prominence within the firm Stevenson and Turner. And it's showing different aspects of practice by profiling these women in the encyclopedia.
On ABC Radio National, you're with By Design, and I'm talking to Philip Goad and Julie Willis about their Encyclopedia of Australian Architecture. Philip, some of the humblest Australian architecture gets a mention here, including under D, the Dunny, and under F, the fly screen. Why should the Dunny be included?
Well, we not only wanted to mention the very famous architects, but also aspects of vernacular Australian architecture. And I guess a bit like the Macquarie Dictionary, you would expect to see an entry on the Dunny and expect to see an entry on fly screens. And so what they do is they show the breadth of coverage in the encyclopedia. And they also, I think, give international readers an understanding that there are very special buildings that you can find in Australia.
As well as the vernacular, Julie, there's popular architecture. What's in that section?
Look, I might answer that one.
Oh, okay.
Popular architecture, again, it refers to vernacular, but almost sort of everyday buildings, service stations, cinemas. But it also mentions things like the Big Pineapple in Nambour, the Big Banana in Coffs Harbour. There's also the Big Koala in Dadswell Bridge in Victoria. And the encyclopedia has a picture of the Big Merino, which is in Goulburn. There are things like shopping centres as well, drive-in restaurants. These are the sort of things in popular architecture. And there's even a slight dig at the architect Robin Boyd because he was involved in popular architecture with his fishbowl takeaway fish restaurant.
Yes, actually, a building that more or less enshrines exactly the sort of thing he was writing against.
Absolutely.
Another quirky entry is L for lazaret. Can you tell us what a lazaret is?
A lazaret is essentially a leper colony, and many of our quarantine stations and hospitals had lazarets attached to them. I should say not necessarily attached, but some distance away, because they're often termed lazarets, but they were used for the treatment of smallpox and the like. And they tended to be very small little timber pavilions, very well ventilated, and in little groupings. The lazaret on Peel Island in Moreton Bay in Queensland was one of the biggest. And they were in operation, some of them, for more than 50 years of their life. Most of them have gone by this stage.
All the government architects right through to the present time are listed, but since you can't read the future, Julie, does this mean the encyclopedia will need to be updated every decade or so? Or should it perhaps be online so that you can update it all the time?
It'd be marvellous to be online. And certainly I know that Cambridge University Press have thought about that as an option. But one of the things we're trying to do here is to document particularly that might be difficult to uncover. So it was quite important to us to include a number of lists of things like government architects and lists of publications that had appeared in architecture. And yes, it will go out of date and we would like to update, but the fact that it is there at the moment is an important contribution in itself.
Final quick question to both of you. You've studied so much Australian architecture for this book. Have you emerged with a favourite house or a favourite building? Philip?
It's a very, very good question. I would always defer to one of my favourite architects, Robin Boyd, and illustrated in the encyclopaedia is the Ken and Prue Meyer House Pelican, now demolished, but it was at Davies Bay. And it was an extraordinary, I think, sense of excitement in the building, its structure and its plan, and the photograph by Kenneth Ross is just one of the best.
And Julie, what's your favourite?
It's an impossible question, Alan. There are so many wonderful things out there. My favourite changes on a weekly basis. I have to say one of my favourite drawings in the encyclopaedia is a cutaway axonometric section of St George the Fifth Hospital in Sydney, which shows all its interior workings. It's a pretty rare drawing to see. So I'd have to say that's my favourite at the moment.
Okay. Well, details of the Encyclopedia of Australian Architecture on our website, abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. I've been talking to the editors, Philip Goad and Julie Willis. Thank you very much for telling us about your book.
Thank you,
Alan.
Philip Goad is Chair of Architecture at the University of Melbourne and Julie Willis is Associate Professor of Architecture at the same university. Coming up next on By Design, Women in Architecture.